This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, squirrel away little nuts of interest throughout the year, and today's the day I open up the stash and cry, "Nuts! Nuts of interest for all!" For it is the annual bonus episode, because the people who appear on this show always say so much good stuff, it doesn't all fit into their original episodes. So at the end of each year, we get to enjoy all the extra bounty. Coming up, we've got a mythical disappearing island, geese, human dictionaries, the dubious history of the body mass index, a Eurovision thing that has puzzled me for years, Victorian death department stores, and much more. On with the parade of bonus bits. Translator and author Caetano Galindo returned to the show to talk about the history of Portuguese in Brazil.
Why is the country called Brazil? And what are other names that it is known by before?
Yeah, it was sometimes called Pindorama, which is a native word. It was called the land of the Holy Cross, for instance, right from the beginning, the land of the true cross, because, yeah, they wanted to please the Vatican so that the Vatican would give them the land.
Vatican's never truly going to be pleased.
Yeah.
It's a discontent organization.
Yeah. They thrive on that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but from very early on, there was this word, Brazil. And, you know, there is the whole High Brazil thing with the Irish, the myth of the enchanted isle that disappeared in the ocean. And those mentions of the word Brazil in Ireland predate the existence of the Portuguese colony here, predate in Europe the certainty of the existence of us.
What?
Yeah.
What is...
That's kind of weird.
I've not heard about this disappearing island.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Google it. It's called High H-Y Brazil.
It also had a few other names, including O Brazil, Do Brazil, Brazil Rock, and just Brazil, spelled in several different ways. And on one map from 1753, it is labelled Imaginary Isle of O Brazil. It was marked on maps for several hundred years, the last being from 1873. It was depicted as being 100-odd miles off the west coast of Ireland, with a bit of disparity in latitude, but it is hard to get an accurate location for a mythical island that is shrouded in mist except for one day every 7 years, very Brigadoon of it. It might have been a sandbank that has long sunk into the ocean. It might be full myth, no one can confirm. But there is no known linguistic connection between the names of High Brazil and Brazil.
And as it relates to us, there came first the demonym, I don't know how to say it in English, but brasileiro, Brazilian, came before the name Brazil. And the brasileiros were the people that traded in Brazil wood, what would become Brazil wood, which is this very reddish trunk of a tree that was used as a dye and was very precious and was like the first thing that we exported and the Portuguese took from here. The word brasileiro has a very interesting path because it becomes synonym with bootlegger, and then with a nouveau riche, because the brasileiros were like a class of people that dealt in that and that went to the new world. Why brasileiro? Why Brazil? Most of the time there is this explanation that we have the word brasa, which means ember, and that the red wood was like embers, so it was Brasil. We do not know how many words that are formed with ill in the end from a noun, but okay. And there is also the hypothesis that it may come from an old French verb, brésiller, which means to come apart in pieces, and that it was a characteristic of that wood, that it would... there's probably a beautiful verb for that in English.
Disintegrate is not a very beautiful word.
Nah, it would esfarelar. And so, yeah, maybe that, we don't really know, but the word is mysterious in its ways.
Are there people that want the country to be called something else?
Not really, no. In the list of our problems, I think this is pretty low right now.
Yeah, it seems reasonable, and being named after a type of wood gets around a lot of problems that other kinds of names present. Elsewhere, there has been so much renaming in 2023 to keep track of. Been excited to hear from several of you about US bird names getting changed, which I will be following with great interest. And here are a few updates about renamings happening this year. Black Boy Lane in Tottenham in London is now named La Rose Lane, after John La Rose, the activist, writer and publisher. Four schools in Richmond, Virginia, in the US, that were named after Confederate war figures have been renamed. Richmond has been steadily renaming things to commemorate different aspects of the city and its history. So one of the schools is now named after the educator Lois Harrison Jones, who was the first black female superintendent in Richmond. Another school has been named for Frances W. McClenney, who was the school's first black teacher and principal. Dogwood Middle School was named this after Virginia's state flower and tree, and the fourth renamed school will now be the Richmond High School for the Arts, because that's what it is. Over in Australia, Gurry was the traditional name and is now the official name of what had been called Fraser Island, off the coast of Queensland. But elsewhere in Australia, Macquarie Street in the city of Hobart, Tasmania, was not renamed. A seven-year-old named Rosie Booker had launched a petition suggesting the name be changed to an Aboriginal name like Kunanyi Street, because the eponymous Lachlan Macquarie had been responsible for the deaths of a lot of Aboriginal people. Hobart Council rejected it though, saying it was likely to result in requests for other streets to be renamed. Well, I'm sure that's the end of that then. In Canada, Toronto Council just voted to rename a stadium after the late Mayor Rob Ford. And even knowing just the headlines about Rob Ford, this seems like a plan that is going to age like fine milk on a hot, hot radiator. In the episode The Box from early 2023, Subhadra Das talked about what is involved in renaming or denaming university buildings, and said in many cases, it's not much more difficult than taking down a sign. But listener Tanya wrote to say, in Brisbane, Australia, our state paediatric hospital had its name changed when it was revealed the person it was named after was homophobic and a racist. Well, not so much revealed as the person in question, Phyllis Silento, a doctor and medical journalist, had published many racist and homophobic statements in newspapers and magazines, as well as some bad medical tips, like saying that vitamin C would protect children from snake bites. And yes, she did do important advocacy in the field of child and birth parent health and in favour of family planning and contraception, but she also campaigned in favour of eugenics policies, such as forced sterilisation, which was enough for hospital staff to launch a petition in 2018 to change the name of the then four-year-old hospital. Tanya continues, unfortunately, it was not as simple as changing the sign over the door, with the process costing about $500,000. If you add to that the loss of philanthropic donors who opposed the name change and took their money elsewhere, it was quite the expensive venture. Probably worth it, though, to remove the name of a woman who, you know what, I didn't want to have to go too heavy on the content warnings today. So look up some of Phyllis Silento's noxious views in your own time. As Tanya's dear old mum would say, they can stick their money where the sun don't shine. The hospital was sensibly renamed to Queensland Children's Hospital, with the idea that it would attract more funding by having an obviously public hospital name than it would with an eponym. Bonus, no embarrassing skeletons in the closet. Yeah, true, Tanya. That's the thing with eponyms. They are so fraught that I've come round to buildings and roads having boring names. Lexicographer and Dictionary Corner maven Susie Dent returned to the show in the Siblings of Chaos episode to deliver so many etymological treats that we didn't have time then, but do now, for how the words text and textile both come from the Latin for weaving.
I mean, and I love the fact that that's all to do with weaving, like we weave our words, like we weave our textiles. I love the fact that texting is from such an ancient family.
Yes, how did that happen?
I think it was very creative. Yeah.
So is it all metaphor for what we're doing verbally?
It's gorgeous. And actually, clothes like that pop up all the time. So something succinct, I think, is from the Latin under the belt, because Roman togas would be kind of gathered up at the waist so they didn't sweep the dirty Roman streets. And so if something is tucked up or tucked in, it's succinct, it's under the belt. So I really like that one. And, well, I mean, they're closing expressions everywhere, but yeah, it's just they've stayed with us still.
Susie has been studying words that make us happy, such as gossamer.
Yes, gossamer is such a beautiful sounding word. So they're the sort of the silky threads that you see floating in the air in autumn time. And this has not been solved definitively, but we think it might go back to goose summer, which means the time when geese were traditionally eaten, which is around Michaelmas and St. Martin's, the day of St. Martin's, maybe. It was called St. Martin's summer for a while.
When is Michaelmas? 29th of September. Okay.
Yeah, so I think around then, lots of geese would be eaten. And this was also the time when these gossamer threads, which are actually spun by teeny tiny spiders, when you can see it floating through the air. So I think gossamer is surely one of the most beautiful sounding words in English.
Yeah, maybe knowing that it's from geese will detract from it for some people.
Yeah, I know, especially those of us who don't eat geese. I agree.
I live in an area with a lot of geese, and goose poos are enormous.
Oh, they are, and everywhere. They're so prolific.
They are.
Someone asked me the other day, why is it silly goose? Why are geese silly? And the honest answer is I didn't know. I know they waddle a bit on land, but they hiss most of the time and they're quite aggressive. I'm not sure why they're silly.
The ones near where I live stand in traffic, which would be silly, except the cars do stop for them because they're so big.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's face it. They were there before the cars. So I think we've rightly stopped for them.
Not so much a wild goose chase as a wild goose wait. Extra goose fact, the word smorgasbord breaks down to butter goose table. After the last episode, Ravels, where we talked about the history of the term cardigan, listener Charles messaged me to say, there is a much lovelier option for cardigan sweaters out there. In Spain, that cut of sweater is called una Rebeca, because of the Hitchcock adaptation of Daphne du Maurier's novel, in which the titular Rebecca wears a lot of cardigans. Well, we never actually see the titular Rebecca at all. The cardigan wearer is the late Rebecca's husband's new wife, played by Joan Fontaine. This character doesn't even get her own first name. She's just the second Mrs. De Winter. Additional knitwear movie fact, in Croatian and Italian, the turtleneck is known as Dolce Vita after the film. Lindsay Rose Russell, who studies and collects dictionaries, talked in the Cairns episode about the under-recorded roles and influences of women in dictionary making. And the genderedness of the genre is evident in the terms walking dictionary and sleeping dictionary.
I'm fascinated with these two terms, walking dictionary and sleeping dictionary, because dictionaries are supposed to be like big, ugly books, but walking dictionaries and sleeping dictionaries are people. And to me, these are just really evocative terms.
It's been a while since I heard the term walking dictionary used, but people did still sling it around in my childhood. He's a walking dictionary, just to mean someone who has an extensive vocabulary, or perhaps used just one word that seemed fancy. But I haven't heard it used particularly as a criticism. It did originate as a bit of a diss, though, and remained one for quite a while. Its first known appearance in print was 1609.
A walking dictionary is a person, but most often a man who supposedly has a lot of knowledge. The walking dictionary shows some of the sort of masculinity of the dictionary because it's often a man, and often in many instances of people talking about walking dictionaries are annoying. They are not pleasant. They just yammer on at you.
Sleeping dictionary is a later term, showing up in print from 1835.
It's still in use today, also sometimes known as long-haired dictionary and pillow dictionary. A sleeping dictionary is a person, most often a woman, who teaches somebody else her language in the context of having like a sexual romantic relationship with them. And so the idea that a walking dictionary is a sort of a masculinist project that collects knowledge in a way that also alienates it from context and use. So the words that a walking dictionary dispenses are sort of without any power or punch to them. It's just, oh, you just know that to know it, instead of knowing it to apply it to something or knowing it to actually amuse whatever audience you're with. You're just being annoying and sort of empty-headed in your universalized knowledge of something. Whereas Sleeping Dictionary shows some of the place of the feminine within some of the ideologies of the dictionary, that women can be, their linguistic knowledge can be instrumentalized for ends that have absolutely nothing to do with them. Their knowledges are instrumentalized in a way that allows sort of men to acquire linguistic proficiency and move on about their business of doing something. Makes the sort of sexuality of a woman the most important feature of her, even though there's a linguistic edge to this. And so to me, these two terms are revealing of the ways that gendered ideologies have always informed what dictionaries are and what they do in the world. And that those things are very different from the things that we tend to sort of celebrate dictionaries for doing.
I heard from so many of you who were really glad to hear Aubrey Gordon on the show talking about fatness and use of euphemisms like fluffy. Aubrey has also done a lot of research into the science around anti-fatness, such as the body mass index. This section contains mention of eugenics and anti-black racism, along with discussion of anti-fatness. So if you need to skip that, scoot ahead 10 minutes.
BMI was not invented for the purpose that it has more recently been used as.
No, it sure wasn't. It was developed by a Belgian astronomer, mathematician, and statistician.
Ooh, a triple threat.
None of those threats were a doctor. So he developed the BMI at that point called Kotelet's Index. His name was Adolf Kotelet, to essentially establish what he thought was the average and therefore ideal man.
Kotelet wrote in his 1835 book, A Treatise on Man and the Development of His Faculties, if the average man were completely determined, everything differing from his proportions or condition would constitute deformity and disease. Everything found dissimilar, not only as regarded proportion and form, but as exceeding the observed limits, would constitute a monstrosity. Determining the average man seems an unnecessary exercise to me, and of course not one that was meant to spawn a metric to be used in modern day healthcare. It was also based on a very small sample group and a narrow demographic of white men.
It was entirely based on French and Scottish, I believe, military conscripts in the 1800s.
They represent us all.
Absolutely. Who among us is not a French or Scottish military conscript? And part of what we know is that in the last couple of hundred years, our bodies have changed pretty significantly in a bunch of different ways. It seems real weird to tie our weights to a ratio determined by soldiers from the 1800s. From there, it sort of sat on a shelf because people didn't really know what to do with this ratio of weight to height or why you would want to know. People who did pick up Kotelet's work were Sir Francis Galton, as part of the move towards eugenics.
Listen to the episode I mentioned earlier, The Box, to hear more about Sir Francis Galton and his part in the eugenics movement.
And the other folks who picked up Kotelet's work and Kotelet's index were life insurance companies who were looking for reasons to charge some policyholders more. And they decided to charge fat people more and over time came to use the BMI as their standard rubric for who's considered fat or not. And then its sort of universality seemed to sort of back its way into individual medical care provision, which it was absolutely never designed for. Even the study that sort of ushered in use of the BMI more broadly was done by Ansel Keys, who's a very famous researcher, and found that the BMI versus hydrostatic weight measurement, or calipers were the other two measures that they used, that the BMI was the least inaccurate and that it correctly predicted obesity, quote unquote, 50% of the time.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's like horoscopes.
You've been very generous to horoscopes with that one. But like, yeah, absolutely. And in all of those cases, the bulk of this research was happening, almost all of it was happening on white people, and almost all of the research happening on white people was happening on white men. Mm. The BMI has never been meaningfully adjusted for anyone who is not a white man of Western European descent, right? So whole swaths of the world are being measured against some very long since dead soldiers from France in the 1860s or whenever.
And there was a lot of medicine of the time that I don't think people would like to continue using now, like surgery without anesthesia, doctors not washing their hands after delivering babies and killing the next baby and parent they deliver.
This is also the era of hysteria and neurasthenia. This was also the era, certainly in the United States, of a proposed mental illness called drapetomania, which was diagnosed frequently. And drapetomania was defined as the irrepressible desire in slaves to run away. That was considered to be a mental illness. You don't want to be owned by a person.
Otherwise, it just not an urge that you can account for.
Yeah, this is an especially unsavory time in medicine, and it's before the standardization of medical schools. It's before folks believe in germs. Like, this is not an era to, like, lift up. This was when we were all, like, mystified by, like, how colds happen, right? Like, we can really move on from that point now. That feels safe to say to me. And even as we use it now, we use it as a stand-in measure, a proxy measure for other much more reliable measures of health, like someone's hemoglobin levels or like their heart rate or blood pressure, any number of other things that we can measure much more readily and easily and precisely than taking someone's weight and going, statistically, that increases your risk of this other thing that we could test for, but we're not gonna. It's a very strange way to go about things.
It's almost as if it's not about facts at all.
Helen, you're coming dangerously close to cracking the code.
Too scared. Must retreat.
Yeah.
Since Aubrey and I talked a few months ago, the American Medical Association announced that it, I quote, recognizes issues with using BMI as a measurement due to its historical harm, its use for racist exclusion, and because BMI is based primarily on data collected from previous generations of non-Hispanic white populations. Ooh, does that mean they're going to stop using it? No. Anyway, take your pick of things that are misused or misappropriated around anti-fatness. Here's Aubrey on the body positivity movement.
Body positivity is a movement that really rose out of two sort of different spaces. One was eating disorder recovery spaces, and the other one was radical fat activism, which in the United States dates back easily to the 1960s, some say prior to that. And essentially what happened was in the early 2000s, a bunch of corporations and advertisers figured out that there was this movement happening where people were trying to figure out how to do right by folks of different body sizes, different abilities, different gender identities and expressions, right? That there was sort of this coalition forming around justice on the basis of our bodies. And many of those advertisers, Halo Top Ice Cream, honestly, even Weight Watchers at one point, Dove, plenty of companies went ahead and sort of co-opted body positivity and put it into 15 or 30 second ad spots where all people could really take away was, oh, body positivity must mean feeling positive about your body. And stripped all of the sort of politics out of the movement by flooding it with, you know, folks who'd seen ads on TV, not necessarily folks who were steeped in a shared like anti-racist or class justice politic or any of that kind of stuff, right? Which also means we now get things like people saying, you know, I'm body positive as long as you're not obese. or I'm body positive as long as you're happy and healthy.
Happy and healthy.
And I'm like, hey, man, I am fat and depressed. No one is going to read me as a person who is happy and healthy. And I also don't think that that means that I need to feel terrible about how I look all the time, nor does it mean that I ought to experience more barriers to healthcare than anyone else, or lower pay at work, or perfectly legally being fired from your job just because you're fat. Right? Like, all of these things are seen as sort of the price of admission for fat folks. And now that gatekeeping is also happening in body positive, quote unquote, spaces, which is rough.
Great.
Great. Neat. I just don't find that particularly productive, nor do I find it particularly productive to shift from a standard of beauty to an equally sort of fickle standard of health. All of us at some point in our lives, temporarily or permanently, will become ill or disabled. Setting the goalposts at, like, you can feel fine about yourself as long as you never get old, is like not gonna help people when most of us get old.
It's a good way to sell products, though.
It sure is. Boy, oh boy.
Want to stave off death? You can't, but you can try.
Yeah, you can look like you are. Fill in those wrinkles. Yeah.
With our face fat, we have achieved that.
That's right. That's right. I got a baby face. I'm almost 40. No one thinks so.
Are you?
Yeah, look at that. Hey.
You look like you were born last week.
That's right. That's right.
Old baby is my look. It's very dignified.
I really enjoy that.
Hold on, we're just going to take a quick break to pay the bills. Thanks to Bombas for sponsoring The Allusionist and for making such gorgeously soft and comfy t-shirts, socks and undies. And if a sock goes missing, digested by your washing machine or puppy for instance, Bombas will even try to find you a matching replacement. Over in Bob, George, Melchior and Susan's house, socks were going missing at an alarming rate, although George's feet always seemed to be well clad, which aroused the housemate's suspicion. Correctly, as it turned out, after they prized open George's door and discovered a veritable textile grotto made with their socks. To make amends, George deployed Bombas's bulk ordering system, buying enough socks to repay his housemates in kind, with interest and compensation, and to complete the east cavern of his grotto. Go to bombas.com/allusionist and use the code allusionist for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/allusionist and use the code allusionist at checkout. This podcast is sponsored by Ravensburger, makers of jigsaw puzzles for ages from toddler to eternal. From two dimensions to three dimensions, they have some really cool 3D puzzles. There's a whole solar system that you can hang up after you assemble it, and it is suitable for puzzlers age 6 and up. Comes with a leaflet for learning about the planets as you construct them. There's also a Pokemon Pokeball and a Pokemon pen holder, both made out of jigsaw puzzle. Likewise, the Death Star, the classic London bus, and various globes. There's Earth, there's stars, and there's Spider-Man, of course. Oh, and there are loads of 3D puzzles of landmarks, like Buckingham Palace and Sydney Opera House, and the Statue of Liberty, which lights up in many colours. Treat yourself to a gorgeous puzzle made by the experts at Ravensburger for a peaceful solo activity or one to share with your puzzle pals. Don't invite George again, though, after what he did to all the corner pieces last time. Buy yourself your Ravensburger puzzles from your preferred puzzle purveyor. Thanks to Canva for supporting The Allusionist and making well-designed visual content achievable for those of us who otherwise do not know how to do it. I have a creative job and I work alone, so when I don't know how to do something, my options are as follows. 1. Busk it. How bad could it possibly turn out? 2. Ignore it until it goes away. How bad could it possibly turn out? 3. Find an easy-to-use service that takes the hard work and befuddlement out of it all. How bad could it possibly turn out? Not bad at all. In fact, fully unbad. That is the power of Canva. It makes it easy for anyone to create stunning content. And if, unlike me, you don't work in a vortex of solitude, you can design and collaborate with Canva for Teams. Right now, you can get a free 45-day extended trial when you go to canva.me/illusionist. That's canva.me/illusionist for a free 45-day extended trial. canva.me/illusionist. And now back to more bonus bits. Historian Dean Vuletic came on the show to talk about the many linguistic controversies and complications of the Eurovision Song Contest. He also cleared up something that has been bothering me, a joke people make about when a competing country scores 0 points.
Why is there this trope of people saying nul point? Because in the actual contest, no one would ever actually have the cause to say nul point, because it's not like judges would allocate nul point.
This goes back to the origins of the contest, the fact that the contest was born in the mid-1950s at a time when French was still an important language in international diplomacy, also in culture. And this is also one of the reasons why French language wins dominated Eurovision in its first decade. So actually, the official languages of the European Broadcasting Union are English and French. And historically, the two languages have also been represented in the hosting of the contest. So even today, you'll still see some French being spoken by the hosts of Eurovision. And this is where we get that catchphrase, nul point, or even 12 points, 12 points.
Yeah, but it makes sense that people would say 12 points, because that is actually something that gets said every contest when they reward 12 points. But they never reward nul point.
Not anymore. But there was a time when countries could get nul point.
Wow. Harsh.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, still some countries, let's not mention any names, but maybe we should, like the United Kingdom.
Ouch.
You know, have also received nul point in recent times. But the voting system has changed now where it's less likely that a country will get 0 points. But yeah, it has happened, and that's also where how that catchphrase became popularized.
From Eurovision to death. On the episode entitled Death, Evie King talked about her job as a council funeral officer, arranging funerals and dealing with other posthumous affairs for people who don't have anyone else to do it. Or Evie has to track down their relatives.
You must have to deal with a lot of people where their connection to the dead person doesn't exactly inspire grief out the emotions.
Yes. Yes, sometimes the person's been a source of great stress and trouble. Sometimes they haven't spoken for double figures years. And there's a sort of, I think they call it a complex grief, where it's based in lots of unresolved things that will never now be resolved, and still feeling that feeling of loss, but with all of these overlaid guilts and anger, and yeah, so those conversations often go the same. I'll phone up and I'll have found them somehow, whether it's through Instagram, Facebook, the dress books, last number dialed, and they will immediately blurt out everything that ever went wrong in that relationship, because I am so neutral and they're so shocked that everything comes out. And sometimes things I don't want to know, like really distressing details of abuse or things like that. And then they'll say, "You must think we're such a messed up family. You must think we're horrible people." And I'll always say no, because, you know, it's so weird how we are put together as families. It's like collecting a raffle ticket at the door and being matched up random with some stranger. And, oh, by the way, you have to love each other and completely get on. You know, what are the odds? If you were matched up with, you know, out of a pool of 1,000 people, you were matched up with someone at random, what are the odds you would love them and you'd get on with them and you wouldn't have any problems with them at all? And so many outside factors can also affect things. Like, I've had families that have broken down because an accident has changed the personality of the person. And as much as
they were loved. They couldn't be lived with anymore. They just were lashing out. And so the relationship of old was still held very close to the person's heart, how they used to be. But they couldn't be around them for the last 10 years because they would just scream and throw things. And so there's that double sadness of lost the person twice. But I always say, you know, I meet more dysfunctional families than functional ones. And I don't really know what a fully functional family is. You know, we're all just making the best fist of being thrown together, aren't we, in this scenario. People need to stop feeling so terrible that they haven't managed to maintain a connection when it's impossible to so do, or when they haven't been able to be that family they see on TV and in films. It's life's not like that. So, yeah, I do have to have very honest conversations with people. But again, that, like I said, with the language of the job being straightforward, it does mean that you get sort of to the heart of things and can have really honest and quite, for the time I'm involved with them, quite deep connections, because you're speaking probably the most honestly you've spoken about the relationship with anyone. Some people haven't told their spouse about things or, you know, their children. So I'm the person, the first person they've spoke to about it. And so, yeah, you have this brief, very intense relationship and then you let each other go.
Maybe it's easier to talk to you because you're not connected to them or their family in any other way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a disembodied voice on the phone and I have no knowledge of them, and they can just say what they need to say, what they probably needed to say for a number of years. You get all kinds of reactions. It's a relief. It's a horrible thing, because I think some people hold out for a reconciliation. Some people didn't want to be estranged, but the person pushed them away and they had no choice but to be estranged. And so it's an unwilling kind of estrangement. There's lots of complicated things that come up, and that initial call, I mean, the phoning the last numbers is such a crapshoot. You know, you'll phone one and it'll be, dunno who you mean, love. And then it'll turn out he's a plumber and he did their toilet last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the one after that will be, oh my God, and there's just loads of crying. And it's like, yeah, okay, I've hit pay dirt here, because the plumber wouldn't be crying. So, yeah, it is a lot of complicated sort of stories that you have to go through with the person. But as long as you're open and just to try and be as human as possible, it goes quite smoothly. I've very rarely felt I've put my foot in it. And yeah, I think people appreciate that relationship while it lasts.
Yeah, I think you being respectful but not emotionally requiring anything yourself makes you an easy person to interact with.
Yeah, my celebrant says that. He says that he has to be the glue that holds the funeral together. So he has to have enough emotional attachment to deliver a heartfelt service and to do right by the family, but not so much that he would burst into tears himself, because they need him to say everything without a wobbly lip, that they would, you know, everyone who gets up ends up having to abandon their speech half the time because it's too much. And his job is to be that person that can say it to the end and not wobble. And so it's similar for me. You get to be emotionally involved to a point, but yes, a disconnect enough that professionalism is something I think people cling to in a sea of chaos.
As well as dealing with the emotions of the living, Evie has to deal with the physical remains of the dead. We don't get very gory in this section. Nevertheless, if you would rather not hear about cremation and some of its alternatives, then skip ahead 3 minutes 45 seconds.
They're doing composting now, which is actually more the person, because you're being broken down into your natural state. When you're burned, a lot of what's left isn't you, obviously. So
what is it?
Actually, the ashes aren't... It's sort of a husk of you. It's gone through so much. There's not going to be much of you left in there. It's what's sort of gone into dust. It's dust, isn't it? Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So it goes through a sieve as well to get rid of your sort of bits and pieces, like if you've got an artificial hip or anything like that. And yeah, once you've been through the sieve, it's what's come out of the process twice. So you're sort of like double cooked chips, but you're the opposite. You've been diminished twice through two sort of filters. And it's sort of a something of the person in there, but it's less than you'd think. And it's not as significant, I think, as you would imagine. But the composting turns you into actual soil where you can be a proper use to people. They could take you home and put you in a tub and grow a tree.
That does sound useful, and also producing less smoke.
Yes, and exactly. It's much better for the environment. Where is your ashes? People say, oh, put my ashes in the garden and with the plants, but they won't do anything. There's no nutrition left. It's all been destroyed in the burning process. So you're much better off doing a composting, which is not over here yet, but it's legal in a few states over there. And I think hopefully aquamation will come to pass over here as well. And you can just get liquidized,
ooh,
which is better for the environment as well, because no smoke.
Aquamation
is what you want. Aquamation or composting would be my choices if I was having anything done.
Aquamation sounds like synchronized swimming or something.
It does. It sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Or did you just liquidize you?
Yes, they put you in, it sounds like a vat of acid thing, but it's not. It just breaks you down with liquid rather than fire.
I was looking at the history of graves and how it used to be that after a little while, the person would be removed.
Yes.
And someone else would be put in the grave, and perpetual graves weren't a thing until like 1650.
Yes. Since there's a lot of people and not much space. You know, Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey was created to naively house all of London's dead.
Oh, bold.
Back in the Victorian times when there wasn't quite as many of us. And obviously that never happened because they had that necropolis railway that went there and took the bodies from London to Surrey. And obviously that filled up really quickly. They were like, oh yeah, that's not possible.
Well, they just keep coming.
Yeah.
Endless supply.
People keep getting born. Ha ha, that's the downside to this plan. People just keep getting born.
Didn't think it through.
But yeah, that's how we used to think. We used to think that there'd be one grave for us forever because we were so unique. And then you realise there's billions of us and there's just not the facilities on planet Earth for everyone to have their little space.
Yeah, well, at least if you're compost, then you have a further life of sorts.
Yes, and you're fitting in a lot better. You're slotting into the world a lot better than taking up an entire plot. So you get your space and you're useful. It's sort of a life after death thing-ish, if you want to have something that's life after death. And I'm going to do it via donating my body to medical science. I've arranged for that now. So whatever's left of me, they can then compost or aquamate. But I said use every last spare bit of me. I'm not fast.
The death episode also featured Cariad Lloyd, who makes the show Griefcast, and wrote the book You Are Not Alone, about what she's learned from making her podcast about grief and from grieving her father, who died when she was aged 15. Here, she talks about how 19th century Brits tried to make the grieving process very orderly. It's not sad, but if you need not to hear about grief right now, skip ahead 11 minutes 45 seconds.
The thing that I find really interesting about the Victorians is, as ever with all things, you know, from plumbing to schools, they just like industrialized everything and gave it a really clear set of regulations, and they're very good at tidying things up. They were like, this is a mess, you know, what we should all do is we should do this. And so they set out super clear mourning rites, like somebody dies, they need to be buried this way, this is what a funeral needs to look like. Everyone needs to wear black, like everything needs to be black, bows on the door, you need to have two blokes at the front with black feathers in their head, you need to have two men with black canes outside your door, you need a carriage, the wood needs to be black, silver handle. And they just started making these rules about what a funeral looked like.
Is it because they had shares in black ostrich plumes and carriages?
I mean, Somebody did. And there was literally like, it's called Jay's of Regent Street, which was like where, you know, a three stories department store, which only sold funeral stuff.
Whoa.
So it's like, I joke, it's like the Primark of death, basically. And you went there to get your funeral clothes. That's how rigid that rule was. You couldn't just go, well, I've just got black I mean, look, it's a black jumper, but sure, it'd be fine. Like, you had to go and get new clothes for each funeral. Imagine how expensive that was. People were dying all over the place.
Whoa.
Women had to wear stuff made from crepe. You had to have jet jewelry because jet is not too shiny. So the idea was that you couldn't have something shiny and show-offy. Like, everything was muted. Everything was pulled back. Everything was grieving.
But you're still going to wear jewelry. I mean, you're not going to go that far not to wear any.
Oh, my God, come on. Who are we? A little bit of jazz. And then alongside that becomes this rule of like how long you mourn. They had set rules of time of how long someone should mourn. You know, a widow famously, I can't remember the exact details, but it's like they mourn for a year, and then you have half mourning and quarter mourning where you can suddenly wear purple, you can suddenly wear grey. But for that first year, you're wearing black, to the point where if you did marry again, which obviously would have been common with people dying young, you were allowed to not wear it for the day of your wedding.
Oh.
And then you had to go back in it the next day. Can you imagine how awkward that was with your next husband?
Like, honeymoon's over, dear.
Ah, babes, I love you, but remember the first one? He was so great.
Did the men not have to wear mourning for the full year?
The men did. They were expected to wear somber, but it obviously wasn't as controlled. They had a lot of rules for their funeral wear. Like, literally the length of the sash on the back of their top hat had to be a certain length. Like, they were obsessed with rules. And they have this set of rules, which is like, a widow is a year, first cousin is 6 months, like a first cousin who's a child is 6 weeks, second cousin, like, literally they've just gone through, okay, it's like two guys sitting there, like, let's just cover every single situation, then no one will be anxious again. Like, they can just look up in a book of etiquette, everyone knows what they're doing.
Which is almost a brilliant idea.
Almost brilliant, almost.
Because part of the problems when someone has just died is that having to make choices is really extra layer of difficulty.
Yeah. You can see where it comes from. And when you read up what the Georgians were basically doing, it was chaos. This is the problem. That's why the Victorians are so hyper nitpicky. The Georgians used to just like bury people wherever. Like, no one had coffins. They were like piling bodies on top of each other. So literally they were like raising the graveyards up to the windows of churches.
Wow.
So that's why this idea of like corpses rising from the dead was coming from, because a corpse could pop up. They just had no regulations. There was all this disease everywhere. So you can see where the logic comes from of like, well, let's make sure that we tidy this up. But again, it's that one size fits all. Like, as soon as you make a rule, well, there's somebody who doesn't want that, and there's somebody who doesn't feel like that. And what's interesting to me is we still have this idea that it takes roughly a year to, inverted commas, get over a death. And it comes from the Victorians. This idea that you need a year of mourning, we have that, let that linger to be like, oh, emotionally, it's going to take you roughly a year. And after a year, most people kind of don't give grieving people much, not empathy, but like kind of like, oh, are you still sad? Like, it's been a year. Maybe give someone 2 years. But if you, my example is like, you know, if you're in an office and someone is by the water cooler weeping and you're like, oh God, what's wrong? And they're like, oh, my dad just passed away like 6 months ago. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, you poor thing. If someone was there weeping, you're like, oh, what's wrong? You're like, oh, my dad passed away 20 years ago and I'm just having a bad day. You'd be like, oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Still, like, because we just expect it not to last that long. Whereas the truth of it is, if you ask anyone grieving, it's a lifelong process. You have good days and bad days. Obviously, the longer it goes on, like, I don't wake up every day weeping. I'm not like just this pile of like crepe and jet jewelry, like mourning my dead father. It's not like a giant picture of him somewhere. But I still have days where it affects me, and I still have days where I think, oh gosh, that's sad. But we're really struggling to move past that Victorian idea of like, it's time, your time is up, now you need to move on. And again, I can see in Victorian society with people dying so much, disease being so prevalent, of course there's a slightly more like, I mean, I guess how much are you going to grieve for? Like, come on, you got to live. But with us, we don't need that anymore. We don't need to time people. People can take as long as they need, and that's okay. That doesn't mean they're not like enjoying their life, or they should get out there, or they're like being self-indulgent. Like, I think we panic that people are going to disappear into grief, whereas I think actually most people just want to spend some time being sad.
It wasn't just the Victorians trying to impose order on the grieving process. Today, we've got the concept of the five stages of grief, although it has drifted from its original specific and intended purpose.
The five stages of grief was from a book called On Death and Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in 1969. She's amazing. She was an amazing woman. She was groundbreaking. You know, she worked in the hospice movement. She was helping people during the AIDS crisis before anyone was willing to do that. You know, she was a really, really impressive person. But she came up with this theory while she was working in hospitals. She was working with people who were dying of terminal illness. So they're mainly cancer, which at that time in America, they just called malignancy. They didn't even tell you like, oh, you have bowel cancer or you have breast cancer. They just say you have a malignancy.
Ooh.
And she observed that most of the time they didn't tell people they were dying. They just wouldn't tell them, especially women. They would tell the husband, but not the woman who was dying. Or they might not tell the child, but they tell the parents. And so these people would be given treatment, fully believing the treatment was going to cure them. And then they would die, which is kind of awful ethically and, you know, emotionally. And she observed that if you did tell them, if you explained to them this was happening to them, they went through five distinct stages until they kind of accepted they were dying. And that looked like, and I always get them wrong and I don't know why because I've written about it so much.
Sneezy, dopey, Rudolph.
Jerry, posh spies. Yeah, it's like denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. So they would go through, you know, they would deny that was happening to them. Then they would be furious it was happening. And then they would try and like bargain their way out of it. If I pray more, if I'm nicer, maybe the cancer will go away. And then they would be depressed, why me? And then they would reach, okay, I'm going to die. And if you allowed them to go through those five stages, they'd reach this place of acceptance where they could talk to their family, they could obviously sort out their affairs, and they had essentially a peaceful death. When I read the book, I was like, fair play, that's brilliant, that's great advice. I don't know when or why or how it became applied to grieving people. Somewhere in the midst of that book being written in 1969, it just became not about people dying, which is what it was written for. It became about people who were still living and having to deal with grief. And it makes no sense, zero sense, to be about people who are living. It's about people who are dying. Of course you can reach an acceptance if you're like, well, this is, I'm heading for a full stop. I'm going to die. So this is why I kind of need to get myself together. If you're grieving, you're still here in all the mess. You're still having to cope with all the chaos and the cognitive dissonance and all the rest of it. Now, in grief, you might experience those stages, but you don't go through them in a linear narrative. You don't hit each one, boom, 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 tick, 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 and get to acceptance.
Well, you're on schedule.
Yeah. But thanks to this theory and the way it's been like subsumed, like eaten up by all media, all films, all cartoons, like all books, anywhere, we now kind of think that's what's going to happen to us. So when you join the club and you lose someone or someone you love really dies, a lot of us come to it thinking, oh, well, I assume I'll go through these five stages. I wonder when anger will turn up. And actually what happens is like hour one, you're angry. Hour two, you're denying it. Then you're depressed. Then you're screaming at someone. Like it's all of this. Grief is every single emotion you've ever experienced happening to you exactly the same time. And that's why it's so awful and so disorientating, because it turns your world upside down, turns you upside down, turns you inside out with how many emotions you're feeling. And five stages, it just lingered so badly. I mean, it's 2023 and people still believe it. They still think that's how I'm going to grieve. They go, you know, if you Google it, like people are like, when do I go through the five stages? How will I get through it? How do I get over grief? Because we want to believe, understandably, that there's a neat, tidy, simple place where we won't feel this pain anymore, instead of the truth, which is, I'm going to have to carry this pain forever and I will learn to carry this pain and the pain will not hit me in the same way every single day. Like it will hit me like once a year as opposed to once every hour, but it's never going to be fine that person died. It's never going to be like a neutral feeling. It's so infuriating to me. It's lingered because it's so appealing and it fits into the idea of narrative that we like when we watch a film or we read a book, you know, that like the person feels sad, the person's died, they're angry, they punch a wall and then they're okay. And we would all love life to be like that. That's not how emotions work. They don't behave like that. So why we think that grief will work like that, I just don't know.
It's a hope, I suppose, that you can graduate.
Yeah, there's this. I mean, you can call it hope or you can call it like absolute. What else in your life behaves that simply? And it comes back to that Victorian idea of like, oh, we can have grief behave. We can tighten the screws on this box and make it do what we want it to do, rather than going, that's not how any other human experience works. The fact that it was written in 1969 as well, and I think we wouldn't take much mental health advice from that time. We wouldn't take much nutritional advice, gender advice, like anything you read from 1969, I think you would normally think, oh, things were different then. But yet with grief, we've kind of gone, oh, but not with grief. Grief is they knew what they were doing and let's just stick to that. And actually, no one in the death industry agrees with it. Like doctors and grief psychotherapists, like, oh, no, no, it's very unhelpful. It's actually quite damaging to believe the five stages. So I understand the want for it, but I think, again, if you zoom out and look at it, why would grief ever behave like that when, especially when, you know, from my experience, like you lose a parent, it's 50% of who you are, like they raised you, like them going is not going to be five stages you walk through where then you feel fine at the end. It would deny his involvement in my life if I felt the same as I did before he had died, if I went back to that place. And why would I go back? I'd be 15 again. Like, that's not possible to go back to this world.
It's a rough age anyway.
Exactly, exactly. I don't want to go back.
The late 90s Styles, I mean, they're back.
Oh, my
God.
They
shouldn't be. They don't deserve that.
You don't want to... Oh, Helen, London is absolutely full of it. Absolutely full of it.
Rotten. Don't go back, Carriad.
The Illusionist is sponsored by Kitsch, who make fun and thoughtful products for your hair and skin. I find myself very drawn to their textured dinner scrunchie. Now, you're not supposed to eat it, George, even though it does look like a fancy minimalist pastry. My hair is not really long enough for scrunchies, but this thing is so gorgeously puffy. I just want to curl up and snooze in it. Or wear it on my wrist, like a Pierrot costume. But the product I really need is the magnetic bobby pin holder. Hairpins are always diving onto the ground, and this is really the ideal way to pick them up and then keep them in one place, because I mean, we know that they wander off when we're not looking. I'm really surprised that I don't see magnetic bobby pin holders sold wherever bobby pins are sold. Kitsch, you are so smart. Right now, Kitsch is offering you 30% off your entire order at mykitsch.com/illusionist. That's right. 30% of anything and everything at MyKitsch, that's MYKITSCH.com/illusionist. MyKitsch.com/illusionist for 30% off your order. The Illusionist is sponsored by Squarespace, our one-stop shop for creating, designing and running our own websites. Susan has been using Squarespace for many years. She heard about it on the podcast she was listening to drown out the sound of Bob, George and Melchior arguing over which is the right end to open a boiled egg.
Round end!
No, pointy end.
Right through the eyes. Nail it right through the eyes.
Susan wanted a space that was hers, just hers, all tidy and peaceful as Squarespace's award-winningly designed templates are. And after all this time, it's still her happy place for selling her line of stress balls, which she sells custom printed with the face of the nemesis of your choice. 25% discount if you buy a pack of three, aka the house share special. She sells a lot of those packs of three. Head to squarespace.com/illusionist for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code illusionist to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's it. The ninth year of The Illusionist is complete, except for the best and worst portmanteaus I've seen this year. In the portmanteau category, croissant, a croissant with ham in it, vibe session, where companies lay off employees in anticipation of, rather than response to, an economic downturn. I don't think this sad phenomenon deserves a jaunty portmanteau. Sklegging, that's a garment that combines skirt and leggings. Primpover, don't make me explain, I can't. Pica mole, guacamole made of peas. And Luxajack, the luxury lumberjack. The best portmanteaus, Vagician, which I saw on the door of a local salon offering intimate waxes, and Squimp, which was a very tasty squid and shrimp sandwich. There's a whole channel devoted to portmanteaus, especially the really stinky ones, in the Illusiverse Discord, which you can join by supporting the show at theillusionist.org/donate. In return for your largesse, you also get behind-the-scenes info about the making of every episode, you get regular live streams with relaxing readings from my dictionary collection, and you get watch-alongs with your fellow Illusionauts. In early 2024, we will be joining with She Done It podcast to watch the 1982 edition of Agatha Christie's Evil Under the Sun, which is really all about Poirot's resplendent swimsuit and Maggie Smith looking spectacular in the 1980s spins on 1930s fashions. All this could be yours, and you're helping keep an independent podcast afloat as we head into the Illusionist's 10th year, blimey. Join us at theillusionist.org/donate. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is pavage. Pavage. Noun. Historical. A tax or toll to cover the paving of streets. Try using pavage in an email today. In order of appearance, you heard from Caetano Galindo, Susie Dent, Lindsay Rose Russell, Aubrey Gordon, Dean Vuletic, Evie King, and Cariad Lloyd. All of them feature on an episode of The Illusionist from this year, and I'll link to them all at theillusionist.org/bonus2023. The Illusionist is edited, produced, and hosted in about 12 other jobs by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick. Hear his songs at palebirdmusic.com and listen to his podcast, Neutrino Watch, and Song by Song. Our ad partner is Multitude. Thanks so much to Amanda and Carly from Multitude for their work on behalf of the show this year. Ad spots are now available for 2024. If you want one and have me talk compellingly and affectionately about your product or thing, contact Multitude at multitude.productions/ads. A handful more thanks to Tort, Lily and Chris for their work keeping the Illusiverse Discord a nice place to be, and thanks to Ashra for the InWitches, which she lovingly curates at inwitches.tumblr.com. And thanks to you for listening. The show will be back in the second half of January 2024. In the meantime, hear or read every episode, find links to more information about the topics and people therein, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and find the podcast on the socials, all at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.